Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided by Voice Republic at httpvoicerepublic.com.
Blog Talk Radio. Today is the day that I say no. I have had enough. Fat, whore, bitch, slut, cunt. Words that cut like leather whips lashing across my very soul. They can no longer enslave me. Instead, today, they are fodder for my strength. For I have had enough. I am no longer deluded by the weeks of false kindness, only to be followed by days of emotional and physical terror. The days you walked past me and jumped to pretend to hit me were designed to make me fear you and hate myself, and it worked. I looked in the mirror, realizing that disliking you was bad enough, but I had begun to loathe myself. I can still smell your skin on mine. In the middle of the night, as you lay atop me, I am choking on the stench of betrayal because you didn't deserve my essence. Instead of intimate cuddles, you dished out slaps across my face. A stinging blow that seared my heart with humiliation. Sorry? Oh yeah, you sorry, all right. Sorry that this is the last day that you will ever lay eyes on me. Sorry that you let old wounds fester and infect your life to the very core, poisoning those around you, making you an unintentional monster. I ask myself, how did I end up here? Well-educated, good family, well-loved. I thought I knew better, but I'm still here. I looked around to find friends and family gone, only you whispering your hatred in my spirit, trying to break me in isolation. But what you didn't expect was that I would hold on to my soul for dear life, knowing that though I am weeping, all the joy comes in the morning. See, I may have forgotten who I am, but I know whose I am. Now, today, I am taking back my power. I rescind my love for you and send it abound back to myself. Today, I say, hell no. Gone are the days that your lips speak the truths of my self-image. I will no longer be silenced by shame. I have found my voice. I stand tall with my shoulders erect and my head held high. I remember the power bequeathed to me by the queens of my lineage. I am firmly spinning 360 degrees of self-knowledge. See, my tears flow, but they are the flowing waters of freedom. For today is the day that I say no.
Wow. I don't know about you guys, but that was pretty powerful. This is Michelle Alexander, host of A Girl's Guide on Air, founder and creator of agirlsguide.org. I have tonight a very powerful show planned for us. It's a subject that has been on my heart for a while now, and I think it's been motivated for me to talk about by some recent events in the news and some personal friends of mine who have had some recent experiences with this very subject. So tonight we're going to talk about domestic violence in the LGBTQ community, sometimes also referred to as intimate partner violence. It's a new term we're going to talk a little bit later on with one of our guests, and we're going to help everybody understand if there's a difference, what the difference is, and all that. So we're going to definitely dive into a lot of that stuff later. But as true to form, how we work here on A Girl's Guide on Air is, as you know, if you followed our blog for any amount of time, you know that we had promised to have basically three legs to A Girl's Guide. One was to bring healing by starting to talk about some of the details or some of the issues that we deal with that are specific to our community. We wanted to bring dialogue, which is A Girl's Guide on Air, and this is our opportunity for us to really converse about some of the issues that are hurting our community. And then reconciliation is the third leg of A Girl's Guide, and we're going to get in and talk a little bit more later on about how we are manifesting that on A Girl's Guide. So I want to introduce my co-host tonight. She is a writer extraordinaire on A Girl's Guide, and I just love her energy. She's an absolute sweetheart, and I have to tell you a funny story. When I launched A Girl's Guide, I had gotten some stock footage, and I used an image that she had taken with a previous partner, and I used it on her side, and my life coach at the time Carrie Smith was sharing the site because she was really excited for me. And I look at a share that she had done on Facebook, and our guest host and I was like, hey, that's me. And I was like, oh my God, I hope she's okay with me using that picture. And so I sent a request to her on Facebook, and I had a conversation. She was more than happy and obliged to lend it to us. So I just want to introduce my co-host, Edwise, because I have not taken Spanish since the seventh grade. So I'm going to try to roll my R, and let's see how this goes. So La Fuerza is
very good.
Did I get that right? Yay! Okay, so I'm just going to call you La for the rest of the night, though, because I can only do that one time. So, but La, when you and I started talking, you had a really unique story that I wanted to bring to a Girl Scout, and you responded to a request for writers that I had put out there on Facebook and Twitter, and I was looking for somebody who wanted to tell their story about their experience with domestic violence. And so you answered, and you started writing for us, and you wrote two powerful pieces because I wanted you to tell this story in pieces. And so you've been able to do that. And we're gonna dive in a little bit into your story a little bit later. But I just wanted to bring you on the air and say welcome and thank you so much for being my co-host tonight. I appreciate
you. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
I'm excited. A couple of things, you know, we all have housekeeping because we have bills to pay and things. We've got to talk about our sponsors. And I have an amazing list of sponsors. Our first sponsor is Bad Girl Media. Piper York, who is a longtime friend of mine, was the creative force behind A Girl's Guide .org. She created our website, her and another one of our graphic designers who recently did our brand new logo that I'm going to talk about a little while ago, Selena Weinhardt. She is also one of my graphic designers. So if you ever need any graphic work done, print work, websites, any of that stuff, I want you to reach out to either Piper York or Selena Weinhardt on my friends list. And I'll post their information on Girls Guide. One of my favorite people in the entire world is my personal life coach, Coach Carrie Smith. She provides LGBTQ life, relationship, and spiritual coaching worldwide. She empowers and inspires women all over the world, giving them the tools that they need to live an extraordinary life. She is one of the reasons that I stepped forward and I created A Girl's Guide, and I made that a realization because it was always something that was in my heart, and she helped me organize it, put it together, and manifest it into reality. So, Coach Carrie, you are amazing, and I just love you so much. Our guest tonight is also a sponsor, Imani Evans, who is a powerful woman in our community, fighting for basically the advocacy for healing our women. She created an organization called Women Healing Women, and it's a nonprofit 501c3 that is committed to the holistic healing of women survivors of sexual and domestic violence. And then the subsequent secondary traumas, support, education, advocacy, and counseling, and that's her system that she has put in place to help out those women who have been abused and marginalized in our communities. And then myself, I always like to sponsor my own program. As you know, I think many of you have followed me through this journey, I am now launching my own coaching practice. And I consider myself an emotional advocate. I actually think I'm going to coin that term. I'm an emotional advocate, coach, and mentor, committed to living a life of amazing. So my company offers coaching and mentoring conversations that are focused on emotional discovery and goal setting and how you can live your own life of amazing. I call it Let's Chat. These are conversations that are going to change your life. So if you're interested, please contact me at michelle@girlsguide.org. So how you doing there, La? I'm done paying the bills.
I'm doing good.
You're doing good. Are you relaxed and nice and comfy and ready to get into this conversation?
I am.
Okay. You, when you reached out to me and you wanted to talk about your story, tell me what motivated you to respond to me. And then we're going to talk about your story. Then we're going to go into some questions. So what made you want to tell your story and get involved with A Girl's Guide and this particular topic?
Well, I responded because I feel like not many folks, especially in the DMV area, talk about LGBT domestic violence enough. And since I moved here, I never really spoke about it, didn't tell anyone about it, and I felt this was an opportunity to use it as a platform to share my story, open up the dialogue about LGBT domestic violence, and get the conversation going.
Okay. Good. And you actually went on, after your own personal situation, you went on to go do some of your own advocacy.
Yes. I started my own nonprofit organization called the Lava Group, Lesbians Against Violence and Aggression, and it was a grassroots movement that I started after my experience, and I went out in the streets and did my own, I guess you would say, guerrilla marketing and outreach to get the word out that there was a need that wasn't being met in the five boroughs up in New York. I went and I did my own surveys, and every survey was a basic three questions asked, if I could remember, it was a while ago. It asked if they had ever experienced domestic violence, ever knew anyone in the LGBT community that had an experience of domestic violence, and have they reported it. And every single person has responded yes, and I got 90% back. 90% of the women that I asked if they had experienced domestic violence all said yes. And when I sought out to get my own services, I couldn't find anything at the time. Everything was catered to heterosexuals and gay men. And even going to get services at the hospital that I needed because of my injuries, I was laughed at. I was told, you know, you should have fought her. This is a joke.
Wow.
And it was a constant circle. I was getting turned away by so many nonprofits, and that's when it motivated me to start my own movement, and I created support groups throughout the five boroughs. I was on foot taking the trains, meeting with different organizations to talk about my organization and what I wanted to do for the community. And from there, it took off until I moved out of New York.
Wow. You know, it goes to my my motto that I live by that says, give away that which you need the most. I mean, you couldn't find it, you created it. And you gave that healing away because you needed it yourself. And so you can see that kind of energy behind that movement was powerful in your own healing process, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Yeah.
The more I helped others, the more I felt like I became stronger. And the more work I did in the community and the more awareness, the more folks came to me telling me their story, and I was able to refer them to get services that they needed that I couldn't provide because I was a one-woman show at the time until I started my own work in nonprofit. So it definitely was a source of healing for me.
Okay. Well, let's kind of get into the meat of your story. I know you wrote about it, you started to write about it, and we haven't finished your story on A Girl's Guide, but I do want to give the opportunity to tell your whole story tonight, and you know, we'll definitely archive it, and people can both read it and listen to it. But tell us how you found yourself in a situation where you were a victim of domestic violence or intimate partner violence, as it's being called now.
Well, it all started after my mother died. Something I didn't touch on in the blog is I've experienced domestic violence my whole life. As a child, growing up, I just had to cut him off. Was an abusive brother, verbally and physically abusive. And then my mother died suddenly when I was 19. I found her dead. And 2 years after that, I came out of the closet. And I entered into a relationship thinking that, you know, this was going to be a beautiful bed of roses relationship. And I also felt like I had to prove to folks who were like, you know, this is just a phase. You're not gay. You've always liked men, et cetera, et cetera. That, you know, this relationship could work, and I was going to prove them wrong. And going into the relationship, I went, my first time going out, I was actually on a blind date, and I went out to a club and met this person there. And from there, it moved really, really fast. I was out and proud and I was very young. She was much older than me. And then it turned into a relationship very quickly, and something I wasn't prepared for because I had never healed from my mother's death. And also, you know, it was just a lot going on at the time. But this woman was pretty much saying, I'm going to take care of you. I'm your salvation, and come to me. And she enticed me with passion and showing me the lesbian ropes, so to speak. And very quickly, she became, I guess, the dominant person in the relationship, and me not knowing really much about the gay dynamics of a relationship, I automatically assumed, oh, I'm the girly one here. I'm going to take on this role. Very naive of me, of course. And she then became very controlling because of my job at the time. I was a model in New York City, and there was a lot of attention on me, and I was also bartending. And she would make comments from time to time, but I always confused it with love. I was like, oh, yeah, it's love. And she just honors me and respects everything that I do and worships the ground that I walk on. But then it just
let me interrupt you real quick there. Tell us, help us understand when you say that she would say things that made you feel like you were loved. What were those things? What would she say? Because I want to give some examples to maybe somebody who might be experiencing this now that may, you know, think the same as you and say, well, you know, she just loves me. It's okay. When really it's manipulative and abusive. What were some of the things that she would say?
Well, for one thing I remember, she became very jealous when I had to do a fashion show. And she said to me, I don't want anyone looking at you or fawning over you or taking pictures with you. And I told her, well, why? You know, this is my job. And she said, because you're my doll. You're my beautiful flower. And she used to say, you're my muñeca, which is Spanish for a doll. And I always thought, like, oh, that's so sweet. You love me so much. And she'd be like, I just love you and worship you so much. I don't want anyone to look at you. And then when I would go to these shows, she would go, and I'm thinking she's there to support me, and it would turn out she was there starting arguments with people who were staring. She would push people who would take pictures with me. She would come up behind them and push them afterwards, and then she would start a fight with me when we got home, saying, oh, you were flirting. I told you not to do it, making me feel guilty.
Okay. I wonder how many people that are listening to our show or that will listen to our show do the same thing. Because I think at one point in my life, I don't want to say all of us have done it. But I think as we're growing and as we're learning what love is and what healthy love is and what toxic love looks like, I think that we all have made that mistake. And the difference here is that it just elevated and became eventually violent. So tell us what happened next.
Well, as I was working in the bar scene, she would show up at the bar scene, at the bar, every single time I had a shift, and she wouldn't buy anything to drink. She wouldn't socialize. She would just sit at the end of the bar and watch me the whole night. And I was confronted one night by my boss, who had said that she was, you know, why is she always there? And what's going on with her that she's always staring at me, but never, ever talking to anyone. And then he said that she went out for a cigarette and went up to this guy who was one of my customers and started pretending to talk to him, but she followed him outside and had a knife and accused him of talking to me, flirting with me. She was threatening him. And then I was accused of sleeping with him.
Okay.
It was a big fight. And then she was starting, we were in New York City, we were on the way home, and she merged onto the FDR, and while she's yelling at me and I'm leaning back in the seat, she just goes full speed ahead onto the FDR drive, and an SUV crashes into our small little vehicle that we had at the time, that she had at the time, that I paid for because she manipulated me into buying a car because I was making money and she wasn't. Mm-hmm. And we were trapped in there. And I remember having to get assistance to get out and climbing out the back window. And she got out just fine. And she's screaming at me saying it's my fault. I was the one that caused her to get into an accident because I was busy flirting with a guy. And
wow.
At that moment, I was like, I am in so much trouble. I don't know what to do in this situation. But then at the same time, I'm like, but this woman loves me, and I love her. And, you know, she's my first same-sex relationship. This shouldn't happen in same-sex relationships. I've always taught that it only happens between men and women. So here I am in a situation that I never knew could be a reality. So where do I go from here?
Right.
What do I do? Who do I talk to? No one.
Do you feel like, I mean, when she merged that car, I mean, was she trying to kill you both? I mean, I read the story, I wonder about that. Is that really where she was going, or do you feel like she was trying to intimidate you and just make you scared and then be able to turn that around on you and blame it on you in the effort to create more fear and more of a cycle of manipulation and control?
Well, later on in the relationship, it came out that she was trying to kill us that night because she felt like if she couldn't have me, no one could have me.
Wow.
And it came out.
Did she ever spoke those words to you? Did she ever say that to you? So,
yes.
Up until that time?
Up until that time, no. It was
later on
in the relationship when things got really violent and the authorities were involved and she was behind bars that it came out.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So it's like you don't even know. You don't even know that could have happened that night.
No.
Wow. So you have this incident where there's a big car accident. You guys make it out. She makes it out fine. You end up in the hospital, right?
Yes.
Okay. How long were you in the hospital?
It was just one night, observation,
okay.
I'm sure, you know, x-rays, all that good stuff.
Okay. And then where did you go from there? You go home, she creates a big argument, and then what?
Well, I'm tiptoeing on eggshells now, and I don't want to add to the fuel. I don't want to add to the fire. I don't want to be the fuel to add to the fire. And she was quiet, but she had this look of rage in her eyes that I learned very quickly. When she had this look in her eye, it was a warning sign for me that things were about to get real. It was either going to be a screaming match or she was going to put her hands on me.
Mm.
And that night, you know, we didn't talk, and she was just very full of rage because she was, like, slamming things in the house. She was, like, cursing in Spanish. She was going back and forth, and I am just quiet. I am not doing a thing because I know that it's just a delicate situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next morning, it was as if nothing happened. We were just a normal couple having a normal morning, and she started to make love to me, even though I didn't want to, but I didn't know what else I could do because I didn't want to fight anymore, and I was scared because she's living in my apartment. I have so much invested in this relationship now. Don't know how I got here so quickly, and she just took what she wanted. And from there, she went off to work that day or wherever she went. She didn't have a job. She just went somewhere. She always claimed she had a job, and I found out she never did.
Okay.
And I became very good friends with her friend, who wound up being a very, like, sister-like friend to me for many years. And I told her the situation. But then again, like, I'm trying to find someone to trust. I'm isolated. At this point, I have no family, no real friends. I'm friends with her friends. And I was trying to confide in one of her friends who she had known for 15 years, and then I started to hold back because as I was telling her what was going on that night with the accident and the fighting, I started hearing that she was kind of defending her in a way. And so I was just like, you know what, I'm just not going to talk about it anymore. I'm just going to let it go, but at least you know that something happened.
Okay.
But later on, she does become a person who saves me pretty much and gets me out of a really, really bad situation.
Her friend.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So in the blog, you talk about an incident where there was a poem that was, you went to a poetry event and somebody was reading a poem to you. Tell us about that night.
Okay, so this was lesbian night at the bar, and that was my moneymaker night. And I had regulars, and it was always something I looked forward to because I knew I was going to be around girls like me. And we had a poetry night, and it was erotic poetry. And there was a woman who would frequent there every girls' night. And at the end of the poetry night, because it was amazing, the woman goes up and she's reading off of a napkin and it's a poem about me. And at first I didn't even notice it was about me. I was busy serving drinks. But she starts to pretty much describe me in the poem.
Okay.
Saying I make her the best drinks, I make her laugh every Friday, and questioning, you know, when is it my turn? Why not me? Type of thing, or when will you be mine? And at that moment when she said that, when will you be mine, she was looking right at me, and the entire bar just started going nuts. Like, everyone was screaming, having a good old time, you know. But I wasn't having a good time because the abuser was sitting at the bar, pissed off, staring at the both of us, and automatically I knew that I was in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'm the only bartender that night. So, obviously, it was me. And then at that moment, my ex storms out of the bar. And no one really cares that she's pissed off and leaving the bar. And I just let her leave. And I wasn't going to react because I knew she wanted a reaction from me to make a scene so I could have a fight with her and lose her job.
Okay.
And so later on that night, it was close to the end of the shift, and she's gone. I don't really care because I'm just like, I'm doing me, I'm making my money, it's about business right now. My boss calls me over and he's like, there's been an accident. And I said, what are you talking about? And he says, your girlfriend's been in an accident and the bar manager is going to take you because she's not far from here.
How did they know that she'd been in an accident? Did she call the bar?
She had someone call the bar, and I still don't know who that person is till this day because it wasn't her.
Okay.
And the reason I know it wasn't her was because she didn't have a cell phone.
Okay.
And when I got to the accident, it was a 3-car pileup, and her car was in the middle, and it was crushed.
Oh,
and
wow.
All I thought was, she's dead. Immediately I thought she was dead. And then I turn and I see her sitting on the curb, drunk. And two women I had never met before were with her. So one of these women probably is one of the women that called the bar. And she's sitting on the curb and she's screaming at me, not, you know, I'm there like, oh my God, are you okay? I'm trying to console her. I'm there worried about her, and she's busy yelling at me, saying that, again, it's my fault that she got into an accident.
Wow.
And her friends were, like, standing to the side just watching, and I'm holding her, and I'm saying, how is it my fault? Are you okay? I'm worried about you, you know, what's going on, how did this happen? And so she tells me a story that she got mad at me because of the woman who said this poem, and she went to Henrietta's and got pissed drunk, got into her car, and was driving. She said she was on her way to come pick me up. Mm-hmm. And when she went to stop at the stop, she went to go to the stoplight, didn't realize, this is according to her, didn't realize there was a car in front of her and kept going.
Okay.
And then the car behind her smashed into her.
Wow. So you get a call. She is been in an accident. Is she at the hospital, on her way to the hospital?
No, she refuses to go to the hospital. And she had cuts on her, all this stuff. She refuses to even let them tow her car.
Mm-hmm.
The car was still able to run, but it looked like a tuna can, but it was still running, and I have no idea how this car was still running. But
okay.
Then she makes me, by making me feel bad again, and me being who I was at the time, weak. I considered myself very weak at the time. I got in the car with her, and we tugged along back to Brooklyn in this car, and the car eventually died halfway there, and we pushed it all the way to my house.
Okay.
And
wow.
After that, we get is a little bit of a blur between that time and how we got another car, because now this is the third car in about 3 months. And things are beginning to change. I started a corporate job because I needed to make more money. I was still modeling, but I left the bar scene. And she was getting money from her insurance for this accident. And I confronted her about it one day, and I said, how is it you're getting money from this accident if it was your fault? And she came out and said that she and the person behind her set up this accident to get insurance money. And I said, why did you blame it on me? And she said, it's your fault that I had to do this, because you're always talking about how you make money in their relationship, and I needed to get money somehow.
Wow. Wow. That's all I have to say about that is wow. You know, one of the things that I want to talk about a little bit later when Imani comes on, because this is what she does every single day, and maybe we can talk about some of the work that you've done, and I don't know if you have touched on this, but the women that are abusing, and I'm not saying this because I want to feel sorry for them, and I think that people don't need to, you know, have and take responsibility for the things that they do, but these are also broken and hurting women as well. And so when I listen to you tell her story about how incredibly manipulative and delusional she was, I'm just reminded that she's just an incredibly broken and hurting and damaged woman. And not that it was your responsibility to fix her or feel sorry for her, because everybody is responsible for their own behavior, but for her to think that the only way that she could contribute financially to the relationship is to cause an accident to destroy another car and then bring you into that so that she now also has something else to blame you on so that she can manipulate you further. Like that, the thought process that goes into that has to be completely exhausting, but it tells me that she's been thinking that way for a long time. I just want to say for some of you who are not listening to us, who are actually logged in online, there are some amazing chats going on right now in the chat room. Some of the things that I just kind of want to point out, one of our Girls Guide writers who is doing a lot of work in this very same issue, domestic abuse, Reese, she says when, so when abuse occurs, rather than reaching out for help, that the victims usually try to work their way through it or pray their way through it. So at what point, and we'll talk a little bit more, and maybe we need to just go a little bit more into your story, because on the blogs that we have, that's kind of where it stops. We stop talking about it, and we don't have another piece yet after that accident. Where does it go, and how do you get to the place where you get away?
So fast forwarding to the incident where I had to reach out for help, one mm-hmm. night, and it's a little bit of a blur to me because of the injuries, but one night she came home, and I was already home from work, and I told her that I wanted to go watch, and I believe it was American Idol. I said, I want to go watch American Idol in the living room, and she said, no, you're going to watch TV with me in the room. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I'm not going to. And when I told her that, I said it like, no, I am not. Like, I stood up for myself at that moment. I said, fuck that. I am not doing what you tell me to do.
Okay.
And she
punched me in the face.
Were
you just tired at that point and you found some courage to find your voice? Or what motivated you to get to that
place? I was fed up. I was fed up. And I wanted change. And my spirit knew that this wasn't right. I was drained. I looked
mm-hmm.
drained. I had lost a ton of weight. People were asking me if I was on drugs. That's how thin
mm-hmm.
I had gotten.
Oh, wow.
And
the stress of it, yeah.
She also didn't, like, aside from the physical, emotional, financial abuse, she also
mm-hmm.
controlled my food intake. So
wow.
I went
yeah.
from being a curvy woman when I met her to being, now I'm almost 6 feet tall, I was 122 pounds at 6 feet tall.
Wow. Okay.
And I looked emaciated. And
okay.
I thought, because she told me I looked beautiful because I was so thin, I took it and I just said, you know, I'm beautiful because I'm thin, and she thinks I'm beautiful, so it must be true.
Mm, okay.
And so that night, she punched me in the face, and I remember screaming for my neighbor. I remember screaming with all my might, just screaming
mm-hmm.
for help, because she was on top of me, and she was choking me. She was scratching my face, and then she squeezed my face so tight. And I remember seeing, like, stars, like, some twinkles. And
mm-hmm.
then I pushed my legs up somehow into her chest to get her off of me, and that's when she looked me dead in the eyes, and I will die remembering this. She looked me dead in the eyes, and her eyes at that moment to me looked black.
Mm.
They looked so evil, and she bit into my left calf,
mm-hmm.
and she held on until there was blood coming from the side of her mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm screaming. I'm screaming in pain. I'm screaming for her to get off of me. I am screaming for my neighbor. I'm actually screaming my neighbor's name. And he's not there. And it was only two other apartments in the building. No one is home at this time. And it's about 10 o'clock at night. And I grab my phone. She takes the phone from me because I'm ready to call my dad, because I had no one else. I said, I'm just going to
mm-hmm.
call my dad. My dad had no idea what was going on. And she took my phone and threw it behind the television set where I couldn't reach it and locked me in my room.
Okay.
And I'm screaming and I'm screaming. And finally, she opens the door, lets me out, and I run out of the house. And I run outside, and it's the middle of winter. I'm barefoot with just the tank top and my panties on.
Wow.
My neighbor, another neighbor who just moved into the building, walked by me and acted like he didn't even know me. And he saw me screaming and crying for help.
And he just ignored you.
He completely ignored me.
Wow.
And I ran to the payphone on the corner, and somehow, I don't even know how, I went to the bodega, asked for a quarter in my panties. The guy gave me a quarter so I can call the friend of my ex.
Because she's the only person that you have at this point.
At that point, it was the only person I had.
Yeah.
So I call her, and I tell her, please come get me. I'm freezing. I'm outside in just panties and a T-shirt. I said, she just beat the shit out of me. And she's like, just give me 10 minutes. I'm just up the block. And she didn't live in the area. She said, I'm just up the block visiting my mom. I'll be there. She came and got me. At this point, I couldn't walk on my legs. My face is scratched up. I'm bloody. I have bruises covering my neck and my leg is turning colors and swelling up. So she takes me to her house, and she's, you know, telling me it's going to be okay, don't worry, but she's not really telling me we need to go to the police. And I'm like, I need to go to the cops. And she's like, just think about this. It's my friend.
Wow.
You know, we need to figure something else out. You guys can work it out. She really loves you. And so at this point, I'm just sitting on her couch making my plan. And I'm sitting in silence, like, I need to get out of this. So an hour or two later, my ex comes and picks me up from her house. She called her, the friend called her, while I was sitting there, and she went into her bedroom. She called her and told her to come and get me.
Wow.
So
okay.
She comes and gets me, and she's being extra nice to me, and she's like, I love you, and I'm so sorry. We should never
start
fight like
that
this
cycle.
Again. Yep. You're my muñeca. You're my flower. And now at this point, I'm like, I'm just going to play along with this because I need to get out of this fast.
Yeah.
So I played along, went home, got myself together for work the next day, got up extra early, went straight to work in the city, and went directly into my supervisor's office. And I had, middle of winter, I had a turtleneck on and long pants. And I went into the office, and I took my shirt off, and I pulled down my pants, and I told her, I need help. Look at my body. I'm in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I just
okay.
broke down. And this woman, I was working in the financial industry at that time, she was a domestic violence advocate as a volunteer for many years.
Right.
And she said, we're going to the hospital right now. She was like, I got you. Don't worry about it. She's like, if she calls you, don't answer the phone. Who else can you call? So I'm in the hospital and telling the story, and I felt like I had to tell the story 100 times to get someone to hear me. And every time I told the story, I was met with laughter, questions like, really? A girl did this to you? Like, why didn't you beat her ass? You know?
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with you? Are you serious type of thing? And finally, an officer showed up who was another gay woman, and I'll never forget this woman because she was so beautiful and so nice to me, and she held my hand and she said, where is this chick right now? And I told her where she was, and she said, we're going to get her. She's like, don't worry, we're going to get her. And so later on that evening, I get released from the hospital, and I'm in Manhattan, and I have to make it back to Brooklyn. I make it back to Brooklyn. On the way there, I call my dad, and I broke down, and I told him everything. And my dad was crying, and he was like, why didn't you tell me? And I told him, you will never understand how hard it is to tell someone what you're going through when it's something like this because my life is in danger. I said, this woman will kill me if she knew I was on the phone with you telling me this right now.
Yeah.
So my dad met me at the train station in Brooklyn. From there, we immediately go to the precinct. The detectives were already informed of what was going on because the officer who was with me in the hospital spoke to the detectives in Brooklyn, and they held me in a room with my dad. And they said, where is she right now? Where do you think she is? And at that time, I said, she's on her way back to the house. And so she called me. She doesn't know where I'm at. And I told her, I'm working late. I'll be home later. The detectives were already there. They pulled out guns on her, and they arrested her and brought her in to the precinct. They take a picture of her, and I have to identify her. And so I identify her. I say, yes, it's her. My dad goes, I want to see her. And I don't know why the detective allowed my dad to see her and actually go in the cell, my dad went in there and just smacked her right in the face. And
wow, okay.
They held her there. They held her in custody for 2 days. So now I'm at my house thinking mm-hmm. I have some sort of peace. And I'm like, okay, I can try and get my life on track. I'm going to move. I'm going to start over. And from there, I'm going to just, you know, work on me.
Okay.
And so 2 days later, that night, I'm asleep, and my dog starts barking. And I'm like, what
Uh-oh.
Is that noise? Like, why is he barking? You know, why is he acting stupid? And I'm telling him, come here, come here. And I go back to sleep. He shuts up. A few minutes later, I feel
dogs
something over me.
Oh, no.
And I feel something standing over me, and I wake up, and she's standing over me with a knife.
Oh, my God.
And
okay.
she looks at me, and she says, don't you fucking move. I just need to take a shower and get my thing. If you call the cops, I'm going to fucking kill you.
Oh, my God.
And I look
okay.
at her, and I said, don't hurt me. I said, don't hurt me because you're going to wind up in jail again because I'm not going down without a fight. I said, it's me and you right now.
Yeah.
And you're going to go down. If I'm going down, you're going down. And she just stared at me. And again, those eyes were so black. And I just couldn't like, understand what was going on with me.
Where that rage
was
coming from.
It was just the darkest thing I had ever experienced was this person in front of me holding a knife. And all she wanted to kill me. She wanted to kill me. Because I just put her in jail. Of course you wanted
yeah.
to kill me. I took away all of her power. All the power she took from me, I took it right back at that moment. So I'm in more danger. Order of protection that I had did nothing for me. It's just a piece of paper.
Okay.
If they want you, they will get
you.
Get you.
I mean, it's very important that you actually take those steps so that you've got those legal steps to you know, be able to prosecute legally. But in the height of the moment, you know, it's not like you can hold up the piece of paper and say you can't come here. You know,
And you need to report it. You need to have that piece of paper. You need to have a paper trail. You need to have the
yeah.
authorities involved because it's going to get to a point like happened to me where I can't handle it anymore and I need them to intervene.
Yeah.
And so that night, I talked my way out of getting sat, and she grabbed her things. She just grabbed a few things and left. And then the next day, I called the police. That night I left. I went to my dad's house. And the next day we called the police because I was too scared. I didn't know what to do. We called the police. She got arrested again. This
mm-hmm.
time, they arrested her. She was released just a few hours later and came back to the house again.
Wow.
This time, she didn't come back with knives. She didn't come back with weapons. She came back with friends and family to come and get her things.
Okay.
So I told her, you can't enter my house unless you have a police escort. So
you need to feel safe. And it protected you, or you felt like it did. Okay.
Exactly. And I had my order of protection, so I knew what my rights were. She then leaves. Never comes back to her thing. So
okay.
I go to set it up where she needs to come get her things with the police escort. She had 2 days to get her things. I set up all her things outside. She got all her stuff.
Mm-hmm.
30 days later, my order of protection expires. She shows up at my door.
Wait, it was only good for 30 days?
Only good for 30 days.
And I guess I need to ask somebody this, and maybe we can ask Imani, or maybe you might know, was that standard for how orders of protection work, or did they only give you 30 days because you were in a same-sex relationship? Was there discrimination with that? Because I'm thinking that there is it's not like it's going to get better in 30 days. You know, all of a sudden they don't just wake up and go, hey, you know, I'm just not going to beat the shit out of you after 30 days, or I'm not going to stalk you. Do you feel like that was done for that time frame because you were a same-sex partner and it wasn't taken seriously?
I think that was a part of it. Also, I never was asked to go before a judge. I was never summoned to court. I never got a chance to say my side of the story and plea for my life. It was more like the judge just decided based on the police report. And when I did get to speak with the DA, it was the DA's intern that I spoke with, and she was maybe 21 years old, had no idea what DV was, and was asking me the most ridiculous questions about same-sex relationships, like the all-famous question, who's the guy?
Okay.
And so I never really got the services that I needed, especially from the court system. So I was pretty much just left to my own devices and find my own way to stay alive. And so 30 days later, it expires. The very next day, she shows up at my house with four girls banging down my door. And I call the police, and the police never show up. I call the police six times. They never showed up. And now I'm hiding in my bedroom under my bed because she's pounding on my door, and I don't know if she can get in or not.
Okay.
And finally, an ambulance comes instead of the police, and she's sitting outside the house with the four girls, and the ambulance comes, knocks on my door, and they're like, are you okay? And I said, I need the police. My restraining order expired yesterday, and she's outside wanting to beat me up with four girls.
Okay.
I get on the phone with the detective, and they said to me, these are their exact words, well, you need to move. She's not going to stop until you move.
So you had to uproot your life, and you had to basically say, I have to move and get away from her, else she'll never leave me alone.
Exactly.
Okay. I want to get
and
a
I
quick
told
piece
them,
of oh, no, go ahead.
Yep. And she said to me, you need to move. And I said, I'm not moving. This is my house. You need to give me my protection and get over here. Like, the police don't even come here. Why aren't they here? And they gave me an excuse. They couldn't find my address, even though I gave them my address. And I lived on the corner above a restaurant. So it just
they couldn't mess it up. Okay.
So after that incident, I didn't hear from her for about 6 months to a year. It was just quiet. Mm-hmm. I moved on with my life. I moved out of that apartment, got a new job, was in counseling, and doing the work that I needed to do for me. So now I'm going back out to go party and do what 20-something-year-olds do. And she followed me to a party in Miami. She got on the same plane as me. She booked the same hotel as me. She followed me to every single party and watched me the entire time. So finally, during this time, I confront her. I confront her when I'm out there. And she was a completely different person. And she's just so apologetic and trying to just, you know, woo me. And I told her, I said, listen, I'm not falling for that anymore. I'm very different now. If you touch me, if you talk to me, if you look at me, you're going to jail.
Right.
And so after that, things got calm. It was a little weird for a while, but then it got calm. And about, you know, a few years later, fast forwarding, because I don't want to give away the whole story that I'm going to write.
Right.
I get a weird message on Facebook from a childhood friend of mine.
Right.
A childhood friend that I grew up with from, I guess it was birth, because we have all baby pictures together, till we were about 15. She emails me and she says, I've been looking for you for a long time.
Oh, and my.
In my search for looking for you, I called a phone number that the last phone number I had for you, which was a cell phone number that I found through a friend of a friend. Mm-hmm. And she said she called it, and this was in 2010. The incident, the domestic violence incident happened in 2003. And
oh, wow.
She said I called
7 years
number.
Later.
Yes. She said, okay. I called the number, and it was your voicemail. And I left a message, and then she said, I thought that it was you calling me back, but it was your ex-girlfriend.
Oh,
I said, what are you
my.
Talking about? Because by this time, I'm like, what is this? Like, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Right.
And she said, yeah, your ex-girlfriend told me that you weren't there at the moment, but that you were going to be at Henrietta's that night. And to meet her in the city, and that they would drive together to Henrietta.
Mm-hmm.
And so my friend, looking for me, she did it, not knowing what was going on. She didn't know anything, but she was completely innocent in this whole situation.
Right.
She's at Henrietta's, and this person is telling her, where's Lynette? You know, where is she? Where is she? And she's like, yeah, well, she's on her way. And she's like, well, it's late. It's already 1 o'clock in the morning. Where is she? And she told
so
her.
So this is your ex-girlfriend asking where you are, basically. She's went to a location where she thinks you're going to be, and then she wants to see you there.
Well, actually, my childhood friend is asking where I'm at.
Oh, okay.
Because she's
okay.
with her. And the abuser
oh,
is, like,
gotcha.
Setting her up. Telling her, Lynette, she's on her way. You know, don't worry about
okay.
it. She's on her way. And
okay.
so she tells her, don't worry about it. My childhood friend goes to the bathroom. And if anyone knows Henrietta, this is that one bathroom. Chickadee follows her into the bathroom, holds her up by her neck, and tells her, were you fucking Lynette while we were together?
So she's not hitting your friend. Okay.
So she's telling my friend, were you with her when me and her were together? And my friend's telling her, no, we're childhood friends. I just miss her. I wanted to see her. You told me that you knew where she was at. And she's like, no, I don't know where the hell she's at. I'm thinking you know where she's at because you're the one who's sleeping with her. So automatically she's thinking that me and this person are sleeping together and I haven't seen her in years.
Right.
And she then pushes my friend into the wall and is groping her and puts her hand up her skirt and begins to sexually assault her in the bathroom and tells her, that's for Lynette. And when you see her, tell her I said that was for her.
Wow.
And so I find this all out. In that same week,
and
I got
Mama,
called.
Mama, real quick.
Yes.
We do have to bring on Imani. We're going to take a quick break here. If you can wrap this up in like 5 minutes, we'll continue this for the next 5 minutes, and then we're going to wrap it up. We're going to bring on our other guests. We've got a ton of people who've got comments. I've got another. I have somebody who's been on hold for a while that wants to come in and ask questions. We've got some questions for you. So how about this? How about we know where this is now? And does this person still affect your life? Does she invade it in her own passive-aggressive way? Does she show up on your porch? Like, where is it right now?
Well, right now, I'm in a safe space. She has no idea where I'm at. She has
okay.
no idea what I look like. Last time I heard was about almost a year ago where she approached a family member of mine who worked at a nightclub in the city, and she was asking for me, and my family member told her, act like Lynette doesn't exist anymore, just
mm-hmm.
ignore her and move on with your life. And shortly after that, she Facebook friended every single one of my friends, and I had to send out a request and delete tons of people. And from there, I haven't heard from her, and that was in 2011.
Okay. And you haven't heard from her since?
No.
But you feel safe?
Yeah, completely.
Okay. You feel safe, good. And you started your organization and you were able to help other women, and then are you still involved in that work at all?
No. The reason I'm not is because I worked in social work for over 11 years, and I became director and did advocacy and worked in the court system, and it just became too much for me. I became burnt out as a social worker, and due to my own personal illness, I decided to resign from nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, for just personal reasons and to take care of yourself and your health, because I can imagine that it would be very emotionally taxing. And I can see why you would do that. So here's what we're going to do. I think that we need to just decompress a little bit because your story is very heavy and it's very heartbreaking. And I want to give everybody just a chance to kind of take a break, go to the restroom, grab some water. Because we need a little love in this room, I am going to just give us a little treat for those of you who were on my show last time. You know that I have this new obsession with Beef Steady and Boom Clot, and I'm going to play Breathe In, which is really a love song. So everybody take a break. I'm going to see you back here in a bit, and we'll continue the story. When we come back, we've got Imani Evans of Women Healing Women who is going to help us talk about some of the warning signs, what you can do to get out of a relationship if it's abusive, and then some of the work that she does, the whole organization, and then we're going to take some questions, and we're going to go from there. So take a break. Enjoy the study in Bloom Cloud.
Of these good vibrations,
we could just
to have this moment.
You're washed out the hands of time. You're who I've chosen.
You can't sit here and tell me that you don't want it.
Just breathe.
I'm absolutely addicted and fascinated by that song. And I just want to say that I did have a chance to meet Bisetti, who is one of the duo party that I went to this weekend. And she's so damn cute. I just wanted to put her in my cleavage, in my pocket, or put her somewhere. She was just so cute. But, you all there? Do we have Law?
Yeah.
I'm here.
Imani, are you there?
I am here.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. So after I put Bisetti, you know, in my pocket, came back to the conversation that we've been having. First of all, Imani, I want to say thank you so much for joining us. You're definitely a needed part of this conversation. And for those of you who don't know who Imani Evans is, she's an empowerment coach, a speaker, and an author. And her motto for her organization is that violence is not an experience. It's not an identity. And this quote was the founding principle in which she started Women Versus, or Women Healing Women, not Women Versus Women, but Women Healing Women. You spent many years motivating others to creatively transform their lives. You're a dynamic speaker who captivates your audience with passion and humor. And you're a professional counselor and life coach, and you teach clients to live their life, the life of their dreams, and you're driven by a passion to see others succeed. So I want to talk with you, Imani, a little bit about your own personal story and then how that drove you to starting your organization, and then we're going to talk about Women Healing Women and what we can do to help the women in our community who find themselves being in these types of situations.
Certainly. Well, first of all, thank you for having me, Michelle. It's really a pleasure and an honor to have an opportunity to talk with you and the listeners of AGG. And I really have been listening to the story of the sister and just feeling really my heart goes out to her and really feeling happy for her that she survived, because that's the key. We have to survive so that we live to tell the story, because there are a lot of women who don't make it that far. Before I answer your question, though, I did want to back up just so there's clarity about something that was discussed specifically, which is the TPO and what is the process for the TPO and how long that lasts. Generally, the standard is that when you file a protective order, you get what's called the TPO. That's a temporary protective order. And the temporary protective order, there may be some variances in different states and counties, but it is a process that is a 30-day order. And then from there, during that 30-day period, you are gathering evidence to sustain a 12-month a protective order. And in each 12 months, you have to go in and renew that order. So the 30 days is pretty standard.
Okay. And I'm glad you did that, because I did see some information in the chat room. And because I've never been through that process, I did not know. And I definitely, one of the, that was one of the things we were going to ask you, so people knew what the process was. So thank you for clearing that up.
Yes. So, and so to your question, I started Women Healing Women because I needed Women Healing Women. I actually did not honestly start out to set out to start an organization. That really wasn't my plan. I really needed some support, and as a long-term survivor of violence, you know, because we think that once we leave the situation or once the event is over, that's where it ends. But emotionally, it continues. It lives in us, on us, through us. And so we have to make sure that it doesn't take our lives over. And so as a survivor of sexual violence, I was raped. I was sexually molested by my father, and I was physically assaulted on a pretty regular, physically and emotionally assaulted by my mother. Now, okay. I'm saying that to say, but, you know, right to this, at this day where I am right now, through lots of my own counseling and healing and evolution, my mother is my best friend. So that has come, you know, people see me interact with my mother and they go, now how do you talk to her after all of the things she's done? And I tell them it's been, you know, we've peeled back the layers. It has not been easy, but it has been necessary for me, and it's the path I wanted to take. My father, who sexually molested me, died in 1990, but I made peace with him as well. So,
okay.
But what I realized is that although I made peace with my father at that point and I was in a healing relationship with my mother, it was still living with me. You know, and it seemed like after the sexual assault as a child, I felt like, you know, I went through this period of promiscuity and this period as a teenager, and then really feeling, once I was sexually assaulted twice, I thought, well, man, what is, like, is there something on my back? Why does this continue to happen to me? And I really began a search to try to discover, you know, how do I overcome that? How do I heal what is in me? And the other thing that I really was particular about is I wanted an organization that wasn't trying to celebrate my victimhood, but rather recognize and honor that place, but recognize that I am a survivor, and then I'm a survivor interested in thriving. You know, that surviving is not the destination, that there's something more fantastic than that, more elegant than that. Like Maya Angelou's quote, surviving is necessary, but thriving is elegant. And thriving is really about being able to take the incident and make it something meaningful in your life, help it give your life purpose, because otherwise it owns us. And so I started Women Healing Women by having a support group in my house. And then it just grew and blossomed from there. And that was in 2004. And in 2005, we started holding support group meetings. And in 2007, we incorporated as a nonprofit.
Okay. Now, you have some principles in which you operate by, four core values. And I would like to talk about them just a little bit and how they play out in your everyday organization. Like, how do you put those into practice?
Sure. Well, I think everything we do, from program implementation, program design, to the recruitment of board, all of it, you know, these core values, your core values are sort of like your compass. It helps you guide, are you on the right path? And the first core value is every woman has a right to be free from violence without compromise. Now, this is one of the things that I wanted to put in place very early so that we're clear. We do not subscribe to any situation that justifies violence against women. Period. Dot. End of story. And that's very important to us.
It is, and because I think that sometimes people want to quantify. Well, you know, I didn't punch you in the face. I just kind of pushed you a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. And I've been through that personally myself, so I get that. And you just want to go, hold on, but okay, pushing me, or taking my phone and keeping me hostage, or sitting on me, or, you know, doing those kind of things, it's all abuse. And just because you didn't punch me and, you know, blacken my eye and make my nose bleed doesn't mean that I'm not being abused.
Absolutely. And it's our human right. You know, you're not doing me a favor because you don't beat me. It's like, you know, the reality shows where you see people saying, well, at least I don't beat my woman. Well, I mean, you don't get cookies and milk for that. Like that's not something you're supposed to do. I cannot celebrate you for that because it is my right as a human being to live free from violence.
Absolutely.
And so that's where that principle comes from. That the programs and the next value is that the programs and services are client-centered and mission-driven, serving only the participants' highest good. You know, a lot of programs get caught up in doing the program that they forget to serve the people. And one of the things that was imperative for me in starting this organization is I wanted to be something, I wanted Women Healing Women to be something different than that. And so that all of our programming, we have to be sure that the client is at the center of whatever motivation for implementation of programs and services, and that has to be clear, and that we are very clear about our mission. A copy of my mission statement sits up in my office, and everybody is very clear that that is what we work from. We don't want to get caught up in who we're funded by, which is why we work very diligently to make sure we have a variety of funding sources so that we're not beholden to anyone in the way that we provide services.
Okay.
We believe, thirdly, that every woman is empowered with the choice to recover and heal at her own pace without judgment or discrimination. Now, this one can be a challenging one for someone because people have decided we're a person, you know, maybe somebody has been through a situation themselves, and so they feel, well, this is how it needs to look for you, and this is the way I did it. Well, the way it worked for you and the way it worked for the sister that spoke earlier, the way it worked for me may be different. And that we give women, we want to meet women where they are instead of forcing them where they should be. And this is an important element to the way that we provide services. Then finally, the last core value is one that I really hold dear to my heart, which is that violence is an attack of the mind, body, and soul. Thus, our overall programming must address each of these areas to have the greatest impact. Because if, you know, if you're being physically violated, then, you know, you get scars and wounds, and some of them can be really profound. But those scars and wounds heal to the outside eye. But violence is an attack. It attacks your soul, your body, your mind, all of your whole being. And so I find that programs that only address one element of it do a disservice to women. And so at Women Healing Women, we make sure that in the design of all of the programs and services, that concept is at the forefront of our minds.
Okay. Okay. Now, is your organization, because, you know, we're an LGBT show, does your organization focus on the LGBT community, or is it open to all women?
It is open to all women, but our primary point of service is for the lesbian community. For women who love women. So that might be lesbian women, bisexual women, and we also started serving transgender women in probably 2008.
Oh, lovely.
So,
okay.
But we had to work with some transgender organizations to figure out the best way to do that. There are lots of organizations in Atlanta that want to serve transgender people, but they're just not sure how to do it. And
not
the benefit of the work that we do is that I have been anchored in the LGBT community for a long time. So, you know, women come where they feel some sense of safety in the way that the services are going to be provided, because so often women go to programs and their pain and sense of violation is exacerbated by the inadequacy to serve our population. You know, people aren't well trained. People say things like, you know, as the sister talked about earlier, some of the things that were said to her when she went to go report this violent situation, and people not taking it seriously because they aren't well trained. So, and then front women are further wounded by that experience.
They are, they are almost, you know, quiet because they almost rather not talk about the abuse for sake of not being humiliated.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
And for some women, you know, if you're going to report it means there might be women who aren't out.
Right.
So if you go,
right,
if you go to report it, then there's to some extent, you know, there's that dual issue of it being out. And then for a lot of us build our family because we lose family when we come out. So sometimes with the loss of the relationship, there is the loss of your family.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of, you know, compounding issues for women who love women who are dealing with this issue.
A couple a couple of questions that I had. One was from a listener, and I think she wanted some clarity on this, and I'm getting ready to pull the question up. But one of the things that she says is, does verbal abuse and minor physical episodes always escalate?
I'm not sure I know what a minor physical episode is. Violence is violence to me. And when someone is doing anything that violates your person, your self-esteem, takes away your control, humiliates you, whether it's minor or big, or in your mind big, it's violence, and it is reason to have cause. Sometimes the escalation isn't in a month or 3 months or 6 months. You could have we've worked with people who were in a relationship for 10 years and the person didn't become physically violent until, you know, year 8. So you don't you just don't the point is that those flags are flags enough for you to make a decision to choose your health and wellness. Period. I mean, that is the case. But generally, and this is very important because we spend a lot of time just helping women, just deconstructing what violence actually is for women and defining it adequately for them. Because not just with domestic violence, but with sexual violence, what we find is women, we will say, have you ever been in a violent situation? No. Okay. Then we start asking questions. Have you ever been, had your finances withheld from you as a way of punishing you? Have you ever been touched and kept to, forced to have sex, you know, even though it was your And they go, yes, yes, yes. Okay, well, that's violence. That's domestic violence. And right. So we spend a lot of time just defining violence for people. You know, so much of our society is socialized to tolerate violence in such a way. We've become so tolerant of certain things that we forget that that's not how we are supposed to live. And so violence isn't about the act that you use to perpetuate it, but it is about the control and the power that
the intention behind it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that's good to know, because like you said, I think that we, especially, you know, women who love women, we often walk that fine line of, well, are we just two women, you know? Well, girls used to fight. We used to fight girls on the playground. And when does it become really domestic abuse?
I just want to tweak one thing that you said, because I didn't mean to convey that it's about the intention, because the intention is almost irrelevant. What's more important is the effect. Because sometimes, you know, you might talk to an abuser, and then, you know, it's easy to look at them as monsters, but they are also just people, wounding people. And
which was my next question for you.
And so, you know, they're wounded people, wounding people. And so it's not really about their attention. It's about the impact of the act. And that's how you judge the violence versus the intention. Because they might, in their mind, think, you know, I'm not trying to hurt you. I can't help myself. You know, and so they don't have that intention, but the impact is still the same.
And I think for me, I looked at it, and why I used the word intention for me was that I think as a person, as a human being connected to your own emotions, you know when you're getting ready to hurt somebody, and so that intention, they have to know that they're getting ready to hurt somebody. You know what I mean? But I completely understand what you're saying. It really is what's the result of the act where you violated. So absolutely.
Well, you know, it seems like they would have to know because you are a rational, sane human being.
Right.
So you do, and so I can understand that it seems that way, but if you think about the myriad of personality types that you're talking about, some of them don't have an awareness and insight. I mean, obviously people who lose control in that way are dealing with poor insight anyway. So they don't have they may not have the same insight. And they may be, some people may be dealing with blind rage, and when they're in that rage, they are on autopilot. Like, they're not making conscious decisions. They are on autopilot of violence. And so that's not in any way, please hear me, to excuse any behavior. I'm just clarifying
Absolutely.
What the dynamic and of power and control is about. Because in turn, I don't want someone to walk away from this conversation and say, well, Imani said that it's only violence if I intended it to be violence. It's
gotcha.
Not.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
How do you deal with the perpetrator at all in your organization? If somebody, do you ever have somebody come and say, I'm an abuser and I want to get help? Or do you have couples that come and say, we want to preserve our relationship, but we've had incidences of abuse? Do you ever work in that dynamic, or do you?
Sure, because, I mean, the mission of our organization is to serve the survivor. However, what we find is that a lot of times the in relationships, there are the couple is both survivor and perpetrator. You know, you see
yeah.
it a lot so in couples.
Cycle.
And so we work with these couples in our counseling aspect of our program. And then we also have a program called Love Doesn't Hurt, which we have a workshop coming up in October. But we have had those programs where the couple would come in and say, you know, I hit her, she hits me. It's not less violent just because you're both doing it. And so those are both perpetrators. When we did the Love Doesn't Hurt program when we launched it the very first time, we had a couple of people identifying themselves as abusers in the session. And so, yes, it happens. And in that case, we do provide some resources and services for them. If we're doing counseling, then, you know, we do provide the counseling.
Okay. Okay. What are some basic warning signs that somebody should look out for if they find that something just isn't right? Is there a progression? And I think we talked about that a little bit, but mm-hmm. is there some basic things that somebody should look out for to say, hey, this, you know, this doesn't feel
sure,
right.
This
sure. behavior is very manipulative. Tell us about what some of that is.
Sure. Well, first, you know, I like the way you pose the question. Is it there's something that just doesn't feel right? Because that would be the first thing. You
okay.
know, a lot of times we are desocialized against our intuition as women,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
you know, and the one thing that I would say utilize is your intuition. It doesn't doesn't have to be adequate evidence. There doesn't have to be anything. If your gut is telling you something is wrong, it just doesn't
okay.
feel right. She looks good. She treats me good. She, you know, everybody thinks she's great and cute and all of that, but something just doesn't feel right. Let that be
mm-hmm.
enough. That would
yeah.
be the number one thing I would say. Outside
I wish
of
more
that,
women allow themselves to feel that because
pardon?
We don't. And like I said, I wish more women would allow themselves to feel that and have ownership and take pride in that because we don't.
Absolutely. I can
yeah.
think for myself, you know, I have, you know, worked to evolve to a different place, but certainly I remember times of feeling that, you know, but I couldn't
mm-hmm.
justify it to anybody. I couldn't make it make sense on paper, so therefore I moved forward and only to find out that my gut was right, you know. And
right.
so we need to, not only do we need to follow it, but we need to make a practice of honing our intuition, you know, really taking time to listen and convene with our bodies and hearts and mind at the same time so that we know that when we hear that sound, we know when it's that and when it's something else. So that would be the number one thing I would say is don't lose your intuition and trust it when you feel it. The other thing
okay.
is paying attention to the small signs. And, yes, there is escalation. I mean, nobody walks up to you and says, hey, you look really nice and slaps you across the face because they wouldn't get past go with you if they did. So, of course, there's escalation. There is that courting phase. I would say, you know, the one thing to look at is imbalanced behavior. So in the beginning, you know, you've heard of these relationships with a person is like day two. They're like, you know, I love you, and
mm-hmm.
I just want to spend the rest of my life with you. You're everything I want and everything I, you know, and there
mm-hmm.
are these extremes of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
That would
mm-hmm.
be a red flag. And
mm-hmm.
when you start looking at things like the person it wants all of your time, and they might do it under the guise of, baby, I just love you. I mean, I just want to spend all my time with you. I love being mm-hmm. with you. You know, we just mesh like that. But
becomes suffocating and isolating.
Absolutely. And you find yourself, you look up and it's been 60 days since you talked to your best friend, or, you know,
right.
a month since you talked to your family members, and, you know, those kinds of the slow isolation. Because one of the things that works for violators, for perpetrators of violence, is isolation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at that power wheel, we talk about isolation as one of the things. When the person is minimizing and denying and blaming you, like, you know, you can't get it right, you know, there's something that I call the Jedi mind trick, you know, where the person is sort of psychological, because they said something and then you call them on it later and they say, I didn't say that. That's not what I said, you know. And so it's sort of like crazy making behavior, and you're mm-hmm. if you're tilting your head to the side, my best friend and I say, you know, if I have to tilt my head to the side, then that's a sign, you know.
Right.
Now you see something strange and you're just like, you know, that if you're
yeah.
doing that, that's a red flag.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a guest on the line, Imani, that I wanted to bring on, and she is a friend of mine here in D.C. Who recently went through a pretty traumatic and very violent situation that she wants to briefly talk about, and, you know, I wanted her to come out and talk with you in the hopes of maybe gaining some perspective on healing for herself, because it is still very fresh. So what I'm going to do is bring her on. Beverly, are you there, honey?
Hi, I'm here.
Hi, how are you, sweetheart?
I'm good. I'm having
yeah.
a wonderful time. Thing.
Good.
This before.
It's okay. No, you know, I'm glad that you were able to join us. You know, I'm a little bit aware of your situation, Beverly, and I wanted you to come on and just share it briefly with us and our listeners so that we can get a different perspective, because your situation was just a little bit different, and it's not better, worse, or whatever. It's just different. You experienced it in a little bit of a different way. So tell us a little
yeah.
bit about what happened to you and where you are now, and then, you know, Imani, chime in whenever you feel led.
Sure.
Hi, Imani. How are
Hi,
you?
Hi, Beverly.
I'm enjoying listening to you, and I think Michelle is amazing, and thank you for this platform. And listening to Nah before, it's like I have talked to people within my church and within my my peer group. I've been mentors to my family and everything that's gone through being raised with, you know, my father's, seeing my father beat my mom and stuff, you know. Thought I had a grip on these things. I'll be 60 in September. And the thing that was really so horrific was that I met this person New Year's Eve. And I consider myself a very godly person, so a lot of my conversation is with including God in a lot of things, you know. So I had not been with a woman since I came out in 1980, but I had not been with a woman since 2004. So, and not with men or anything. I just was, everything was toxic, and my last relationship was horrible, and I just needed time to be with me and to just grow within me and doing. And so, you know, this year I went, you know, I want to come out. I want to have fun. I want to, you know, play with people. And I go, and I met this person New Year's Eve at one of my best friend's houses, you know, for Kwanzaa and New Year's Eve, and I knew her in a community, but we really didn't know each other, you know. And so this was January 1st, and then I got sick for 2 weeks, and we kind of text each other, and texting can really mess you up because you think you know a person, and we were texting back and forth about what we knew and stuff and all that. And to go back to it, I was this person. I was always the diva in the relationship. People will call me a high-maintenance diva, but I'm a high-standard diva, you know, and I make my own money, and I like nice things and shoes and this and all that and furs. And so I was always the dominant person in a relationship as far as the femme and, you know, the Big Mama's presence, and I was that person, you know, that I thought that every woman that I was with, you know, thank God every morning that they were with me and I was talking to them. I was that for 20, 40 years, you know. And so then I meet this person July 1st, and I don't know if it's just coming out and asking God to send me someone to play with, but, you know, the devil be listening too and send me somebody. And so I didn't know that Satan had showed up. But anyway, and so we talked back and forth on texting and did all this and stuff. So I didn't have the standard, if you want to say that word, of having the control and having them say things to me and you know, all those red flags that I was in a position to tell people, mentoring them, to tell them to look out for. I didn't have those, you know. I mean, actually, as a matter of fact, I was actually found myself on the other end pursuing her. And she really wasn't the person that I would have pursued in my past, you know. She didn't, you know, the first time I cooked her dinner, she never came over with anything, and, you know, she didn't come with a hostess gift or flowers or champagne. I drink champagne every day, first of all. But, I mean, so we had gone through that. But, so, you know, I felt like the emperor had no clothes on, if you remember that fable that we learned as kids. And but all my friends and my family and my daughters saw that, and I was just saying, well, no, I think she's a nice person. So I felt like this needy, and the kids was calling me thirsty, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing her, and so she was constantly telling me that she didn't want to be in a relationship and she didn't want to be in that. But in the back of my mind, you know, I was going, I don't want to talk to you, because she wasn't meeting my standards of how, over 60 years, how I wanted to be treated, you know, how I wanted to be placed on the pedestal. And it was like she was going out of her way, because she knew of me, but we didn't really know each other. And so it was like she made it her business of going, I'm not placing you on that pedestal that everyone else had placed you on previously, you know. But then I felt like I was a pursuer. Oh, okay. She was a club person, and I was inviting her out to other things and meeting other people and people of my caliber. It wasn't that you weren't capable of it, or you weren't of this caliber. You know, I was just introducing her to my level of what I felt like, you know.
You were basically introducing her into your circle of people,
my friends and educated friends and nice friends and stuff, because I really wasn't in this clique. I really wasn't in this club thing and all this stuff, you know. And she was a part of this club in D.C. called Remington's, and they do shows and things and stuff they do. She's a very aggressive woman, so they do, you know, the drag shows, and she does the men things and things like that. And I really wasn't a part of that, you know, so she introduced me to that, but I was introducing her to other things. So I was really felt like I was chasing her and making that, and she took that and ran with that. And so she made it seem like, you know, I was chasing her and was going with her. So, but I never really felt this violent side of her and stuff, you know. Every time we would have an argument and stuff, and I would break it up and go, no, I don't want to be with you. You're not the one. You know, my friends, Super Bowl Sunday, I had everybody over, and my daughter, and everybody was saying, this is not the one. This is this person acting like you're doing her a favor, you know. But I was not seeing the emperor with no clothes on, you know. So anyway,
I was going to say, how did you find yourself in a place where what happened? Yeah, kind of fast forward to that space.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, so anyway, but I was still being me in a way. And what happened was one night I had gone to Remington with her, and she went home that night, and she had a car accident. And she called me about 2 o'clock in the morning and said, I'm in a car accident. And then she called me, and I was like, oh, my God, right, you know. And I ran up to the street to Silver Spring and got there and hugged and kissed her and everything and all the stuff. So the police came, and she was arrested for DUI. And I stayed there with her through the court proceedings and police and everything, and it was on a Sunday, and I took her home. It was like 7 o'clock in the morning, and I had to come to work and did all this because this is my friend. This is the person I care about and all this.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 2 weeks later, she texted me one Sunday morning, July 14th. She texted me and said that she could no longer be my friend because I had betrayed her and told somebody about her DUI. You know, this was a secret. This was like her 1800th DUI. And so I actually got mad that morning because I was actually was not going to play with her anymore. And so we had words back and forth. I said, stay away from me. I actually loaned her money to get her car repaired and all this stuff after the accident. I said, stay away from me. I don't want to have anything to do with you. I felt like I was talking to Jesus. He was like, the word betrayal sent me off, you know. And we had these words back and forth, and I said, stay away from me. Keep the money, whatever. And I said, and I looked up, and I came home 7 o'clock that evening, and she was sitting in my parking lot. I still did not feel fearful, you know. I was raised by drag queens. First of all, I'm a fan of comics, so things will come in. But I was raised by drag queens, so I have a powerful mouth. You know, I will cut people with my mouth. And so she came over, and we had words and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, I was standing in my doorway, which is a secure doorway, and she kicked me in my chest down. And she didn't leave me there. She kicked me in my chest and actually drugged me into my apartment and continually kicking me and beating me and kicking me and beating me. And I was screaming. You know, I felt like I was telling people I was screaming like Trayvon because Trayvon was on the TV at that moment. And my neighbors came, and when she saw my neighbors in my doorway, she ran and went to the club. Went to the club after beating me because I told people, I said, she didn't hit me. She beat me. And went to the club and partied afterwards and did all that. And so now I'm on this other side. Like I said, I've been mentoring people like law and in programs like Imani and all this stuff. And now I'm on the other side, and I'm going, how did this happen to me? How did it, you know, and with law I related to, I called the police. Well, my neighbors called the police. When the police came, once they heard it was woman on woman, they took no notes. They didn't ask me if I needed to go to the hospital, and I'm very dark. I'm like blue-black dark, so my bruises didn't show up until the next day. They didn't take any notes. They didn't do anything. They didn't ask my neighbors about anything. They didn't go after her, and with the help of my friends that had gone through it, they actually told me to stay on it. I called the gay liaison unit. I called them every day. I called the domestic violence people. I called them every day. They knew my name when I called. And I actually, when I went to get the restraining order, they arrested her in the court that day, you know. So we're now in this court case continuing to go into that. But I wanted to be a part of this because I was a part of the stories of you knowing the signs and you are still in the abusive relationships, people go and don't realize that they hit you once, they will hit you again. Mm-hmm. And so now, I found myself going, how did this happen to me? And I've been knowing this person since January 1st. So we're talking like 5 months. And so sometimes you don't get those signs in 5 months. You know, I mean, I can look back now, hindsight, and go, my signs were, this person did not treat me like the queen that I know I am, and I should have gotten out of it. But that was the only sign. There was no, you know, controlling signs. There were no, you know, you must do this, you must come here. I think the only thing controlling was, to see me, you must come to this club. So, you know, with Imani, I wanted to ask was, you know, sometimes in short-term relationships, I mean, that was the first time I heard about intimate partner violence. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you don't hear that. You don't understand that. And so that's not addressed. You know, the program I want to start now is putting the attackers on blast. You know, when I started talking to the prosecutor and my lawyer, they wanted to come up with saying, well, she doesn't have a record, And so we're going to offer her plea guilty, and after 9 months of probation, you won't have a record. And I disagreed because I went, well, she's done this before. And so now she would never have a record. You're giving these attackers get-out-of-jail-free cards, mm-hmm. you know. So if she hits someone 10 months later, there still won't be a record. You know, mm-hmm. these people are going out. And then it was harder for me from people that were being in relationships and continuing with the abuse and me a first timer going, oh, hell no, this is not going to happen again. And pursuing, you know, you have to convince the court and you have to convince prosecutors and you have to convince these people. But they do shut down when it's girl-on-girl crime.
Mm-hmm.
They don't take it seriously at all that this happens, and especially that it does not happen in than a year. So, Imani, I wanted to ask you that with your program, is there some talk of, because the only thing I can pull up now is relating to teen violence. They have programs for teens to look out for and stuff, not for a 60-year-old to look out. But do you address that there is something in place or something that we can talk to you about when it's under 6 months?
Yeah, I mean, our programs aren't particularly – first, let me just say, I always have to say whenever I'm talking to a survivor, I'm sorry that was your experience and I'm glad you survived it. Because the reality we know is that, you know, women's chances of increased violence and death occurs when she attempts to leave. So, you know, that's why as supporters we have to be very careful about telling women, well, you just need to leave. You know, that may work for one person, but it may not be the case for somebody else. And sometimes women die in the leaving. And so the leaving has to have a plan. So I just want to say I'm sorry you had that experience, and I'm glad you survived it. Now, our programs don't differentiate between the amount of time. For us, that isn't a significant element of our providing support. Violence can happen on a first date. It can happen 10 years into the relationship. And it is all the same. And you're right in that the justice system is behind the eight ball in understanding how to deal with our community. And it isn't, I will tell you, just because I know in the work that we do, it isn't even just with women. It's men on men, too. I've seen them negate men, too. And so there are a lot of us providing training for the justice system, and there are some things that have been implemented and changed, and they are providing some training. But, you know, we can provide training all day. There's also a homophobic, xenophobic mindset that exists with the actual people carrying out the laws. So there's that. And I think that I would commend you on one of the things that we always tell women to do is be persistent and don't give up and find the support. There's the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence is a great place to get understanding of law and what your rights are and what are the key words to say to the police and to the courts when you need to get what you need to get. Understanding laws, like there's VAWA, there's the Violence Against Women Act, which was enacted in 1994 by actually Joe Biden. And it every year, you might have heard a lot about it in the news now, but there are some protections under VAWA that we have that women don't know about, like protections, you know, things about around women and their pets and how they can't be kicked out of complexes or their apartments because of a violent situation. All those things are protections provided under VAWA. And so I would say the number one thing is take some time and look up the Violence Against Women Act or VAWA, go to the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence website, gcadv.org is what I believe it is, and be educated. And that's important to do whether you are a survivor or you are someone who knows a survivor or just as an active member, a change agent in our community, so that you have that information because no one is exempt. You know, violence isn't for poor people. you know, it isn't for people who aren't smart. It's everybody is affected by it. You know, we've counseled.
You know what? I want to get with the people. I have talked to people.
Sure.
Not to cut you off, but I have talked to people that's in a situation like me that would say, it happened to me one time and I went, hell no. It's not going to happen to me too again. I'm going to say, okay, it's happened to me one time, and I went hell no and stayed on it and do something. But I feel like I think there needs to be a database. You know, there needs to, because people don't come with signs. I think there needs to be a database, just like sexual pedophiles. You are an abuser. So when I gave this passionate speech to the prosecutor and said, you can give her a plea deal, you know, of saying that he wanted to give her a plea deal of saying plead guilty, and in 9 months you would go on probation, and after 9 months you will be with no record. And I was like, that's unacceptable, because, you know, I still have a scar over the top of my eye that is going to be there probably for the rest of my life, you know. So I'm going to see that after 9 months. So you're telling them in 9 months they're going to be a reborn baby with no scars or anything, you know. So if they do it again next year, it's going to be the same thing. They will pull up their record and they won't see anything, because you keep giving them get out of jail free cards. So these attackers must be addressed. I don't care if it happens in 5 minutes. I don't care if it happens in 5 months. I don't care if it happens in 5 years, you know, because you have people after 9 months, you have women, children, men that are in shelters, you know, after 9 months, but the attackers are going on. And most of these attackers, in my case, because you become a victim, that's when I say people should not relinquish that title. Yes, we are victims, and we will remain a victims. And what we do with that is not have a pity party with the victim, you know, being victimized. But, yes, we were victims. But now take that and fight that and go for it and go forward with it, because – you know, help other people that go. Don't just say it happened to me one time and walk away and get over it. Let it be the past. Because there are physical scars. There are mental scars. You have all these consequences. You know, you keep replaying it over in your head and going, I mean, I'm in therapy now. I didn't know that, you know. I mean, there are things, like I said, I mentored other people and talked to them, but I didn't know until I got in a situation that there are things that now you can't get rid of in 9 months.
Well, absolutely. You know. And actually, our program is specifically, we focus mostly on long-term survivor issues, and those are those issues, those relationship issues, PTSD. And I feel like everybody has, you know, I think that, you know, I respect what you're saying about the word victim. For me and for us, for Women Healing Women, we are... words are very important, and they have power. They have life. And so I like to use my words very intentionally. And anytime I use the word I am, it is a prayer. It is a manifestation. So I don't put anything after I am that isn't anything I'm trying to project into the future. That isn't about minimizing the experience, because no one is saying that violence is a one-off. And just like we talked about the core values for Women Healing Women, it is Women Healing Women, we talk about violence is an attack of the mind, body, and soul. And like Michelle and I were talking earlier, it doesn't end with the scars. The scars heal up to the visible, but there's post-traumatic stress disorder, there's depression, there's eating disorder, there's sexual dysfunction, there's all kinds of things that go on way longer. But one of the things I want to commend you on, because I think it is exactly what I mean when I say surviving is, you know, surviving is necessary, but thriving is because you are a survivor. And the reason why I identify you as that, this is, you know, not for you to own, it's just what I'm saying, it's my perception, is that you are already talking about the ways in which this experience is going to propel you forward to make change. So it has propelled you as a change agent, and you may have been doing the work in one way before, but now –
I have a testimony.
Yes,
yeah.
You have a testimony.
I have a testimony.
Not only that,
hey,
you
ladies,
won't, you
ladies,
won't let,
ladies,
you
ladies,
won't
ladies.
Let closed doors scare you. You've already said, no, you will listen to me. You will
yeah.
listen to me. And that
yeah.
is... And that is a powerful thing. And so if that experience is part of what transmuted your experience so that now you were an advocate before, but now you're super advocate. But I want to say this one thing to you, sister.
The attackers weren't, one, I mean, to be compassionate, the attackers were not getting help. I love you when you say that if a couple comes to you and want to work out and stuff, but you still don't have that attacker coming on their own and going, you know, look, I have a problem. I you know, my rage will get so far that the
sure.
only solution is hitting people, you know, hitting that person. And, you know, and I just felt like that there was no one addressing this in the short term period. I don't, you know, so now I was telling Michelle, you know, when I was talking to the court authorities, I felt so helpless because I did not have a story. They would ask me, well, even with the restraining order, well, do you think she's going to come back? I don't know. I didn't think she would do this, but you know what? I have
yeah.
to look up and go, I've only been known her 5 months. I don't know. You think she's going to be outside when you walk her dog? I don't know. You think she's going to hit you again? I don't know. This person hit me and beat me because she thought I had told one of her secrets of being arrested for DUI. So now I find out when they arrested her, she spent the night in jail. She's now, she has a security clearance, you know, works for the government defense department, flies to Afghanistan 4 or 5 times a year. So all that could be lost. So it's like, what are you going to do to me now that you mm-hmm. might lose all this? What are you going to do to me now? So every time I walk out my door, yes, I am scared. Yes, I am afraid. But, you know, I have to put one foot in front of the other. You know, I have to go to work. I have to go out here. I have to do none stuff. But the fear does not leave. So these attackers, you know, I want to put them on billboards. I want to put them on, you know, the news. I want when they go and put something in, I want their picture to come up like pedophiles. I want them across the nation. There should be some database.
And I think that should be your drive. And I just want to leave it with this because I know we're at wrap-up time. I just
yeah,
want to
we are.
Say
Thank
this
you.
One thing, that the first thing, your highest priority, sister, you know, we talked about, you said this happened in January, so you're still fresh. And so I want to say I commend
you
on this.
July 14th. It happened July 14th, so I'm still
okay. Fresh. Okay, so that's even more fresh. Your highest priority is your wellness and healing so that you can be that effective advocate. And these ideas that you have will be, you know, on the horizon as you really address your healing and wellness. So,
okay.
You know, and
I wish you
well on that journey, sister. I do.
Thank you so much.
Beverly,
thank
you so much for coming on, honey. And, you know, we'll definitely be in touch. I'm going to get you the information for Imani's organization. But, Imani, you've been awesome. And thank you so much. I want to tell Law thank you. I want to say thank you to the listeners. I want to say thank you to everybody who's been in the chat room and who has posted on Facebook. I know that there was a lot of push behind the show. And I think that it was something that was absolutely necessary. So what we're going to do now is we have another Girl Guide writer who has an amazing poetry piece that she is going to do live for us addressing this subject. And we're going to go ahead and say hi to Reese. How are you, honey?
I'm wonderful. Enjoying the show very much.
Good. And you also do some work in the arena of domestic violence. Well, I've been seeing you chime in on the chat room, and so thank you for, you know, answering some questions in there and giving us some facts as well.
Yes, of course.
So,
yeah, I'm a domestic violence advocate, so it's always a topic I'm impassioned about. So.
Yeah. So we've got about 3 minutes on air, and I just want to give you an opportunity to we just got the 90-second warning. Just wanted to give you an opportunity to share some of your craft with us because you are a very talented poet as well. So tell us a little bit about your piece, and then you've got about 75 seconds before we are off air.
Okay. All right. This is a piece called The Worst Yet to Come. Those who are still on the phone can listen, or those who listen in the archives. But it's called Worst Yet to Come, and it's about the enduring effects of abuse after you have left the situation.
Okay.
All right, I'll go ahead and get into it.
Yeah.
I am a survivor. Have overcome that which others know little of, but my new love does not easily read me. The lines at the corners of my eyes are seen by her to be only a beautiful sign of aging, and no amount of lyrical lines on a page could ever be expressed to her in such a way that she might then gain an understanding of what I endured long before she ever met me. Thinking back to nights of torturous questioning, was screened in angered supposition as a previous partner's jealous accusations were hurled, yanking me violently from my slumber like cyclonic winds ripping its skin, exposing the skeletons of some imagined hidden secrets, denying sins I had never committed, giving exacting accounts and details of every single minute spent out of her presence until such time as she was satisfied that my eyes weren't hiding behind them, some clandestine meeting. Beatings for affairs never came with ample warning in which to escape them, and my attempts to escape from them were always thwarted by my body's inability to go without sleep, for that seemed to always be the time in which she could capture me. Glaring down with eyes of murderous contempt, her lungs consuming stale air like bulls charging in Pamplona, until fists crushed bones like ice, shattering the security found only in dreamless coma. And for me, there came no justice, just us, fighting endlessly night after another. Police gritting their teeth, inspecting fresh bruises, coloring my cheeks, saying to me, that's what you dykes deserve, and leaving me alone to fend for myself. And please, would someone tell me who the hell orders of protection serve to protect someone who worries not if newspapers print stories about their crimes after they're sent home from doing state time, still on paper? Jailed nights spent contemplating and seduced by plotting of her revenge. For her, not a question of right nor wrong, but whether just one more good opportunity to put her hands back on me. First steps of freedom upon concrete led her directly into the direction of the city where I laid my head at night. Locked on doors and hidden buildings served no protection, not from someone consumed by imagined thoughts of my indiscretion, sensations tingling for slight seconds before knuckles met flesh, and only the Sandman heard me confess at this time. I wish she'd just kill me for living on the run as slow, torturous execution for the crime of only attempting to protect myself. So forgive me if even though years have passed, I still don't sleep lightly. Nightmares of the nightmares I survive from still taunt me, and the demons of my past are so haunting that napping for half-hour increments leaves the skin around my eyes wrinkled. Though now, the new love I've just discovered doesn't understand that when she pulls the covers over our heads so as to make love to me in the safety of our bed, I just feel uneasy. And though I may have insecurities about my body, I insist that we leave the lights on with the hidden knife close by my head that she's unaware of. And when she kisses away the tears from my colorless cheeks, after she's shaken me awake from night terrors, she just doesn't understand. She whispers sweet healing poetry, naively thinking her rhymes can erase these lines around my eyes. But what she does not know is that while she rests there comfortably in the bed at night sleeping, I instead lie awake praying, watching, and waiting for the worst yet to come. And that's the poem.
Thank you, Reese. I appreciate
you.
All right, everybody, I see a lot of people are still chimed in. We are done recording, so it didn't just cut us off, but I just want to say again, thank you to Imani, thank you to La, thank you to Reese, thank you to Beverly for sharing your story. I know that that was tough. Tune in 2 weeks, and we're going to have some more hot topics. So go to A Girl's Guide, A-G-U-R-L-D-G-U-I-D-E, for updates on what we're doing. And to hear a recording of this, definitely share it with your friends. I think this is information that we all need to talk about.
because what we do here at A Girl Said is we talk about the ugly in the effort to make it beautiful. You guys have a wonderful rest of the week, and we will see you soon.
You have been listening to a recording provided by Voice Republic at http://voicerepublic.com.